This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Louisa Han, and I'm really happy to be joined by Yanis Varoufakis to talk about his new book, Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, which was published towards the end of last year by Melville House. Yanis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Louisa.
So I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with your work, but for the benefit of those who aren't, could you just tell us a little bit about your background, both in kind of academia and the wider political sphere?
Well, I'm an academic economist. I spent decades working on something called game theory, very esoteric. I was writing books for 20, 30 people at most around the world. And I was very happy doing that until sometime around the early 2000s, I started feeling that a major tsunami was coming away from Wall Street, similar to 1929. And then I started panicking, literally panicking. And I decided that I didn't have the moral right to confine myself to my esoteric mathematical economic thinking and work. So I started speaking out and... You know, one thing led to another. After 2008, I published a book on the Wall Street collapse and the repercussions, because for me, 2008 was to capitalism that which 1991 was to communism, a death knell, a major crash from which it would never recover. And then, of course, the repercussions of that were that Wall Street's collapse led to the bankruptcy of every single European bank. And once that happened, then flimsily financed states began to topple. And Greece, my native Greece, was the first country, state, government to go under. And the panic hit, you know, the roof, went through the roof, and my panic. And I started warning Greek governments not to take a huge credit card from which to pretend to be repaying the debt that could never be repaid. And of course, this is exactly what they did. So we were condemned to permanent bankruptcy. And then the more I talked, the more I put forward proposals as to what should be happening, the nearer I got to ending up, this is from finance minister. I inherited the finance ministry, which was completely and utterly bankrupt. And so I was the finance minister of the most bankrupt state in Europe. My number one priority was to to exit that bankruptcy. My efforts were undermined by my own government, so I resigned. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So just to kind of introduce your book briefly, techno-feudalism seemed to me to encompass several things at once, kind of a lesson in historical materialism, a whistle-stop tour of kind of capitalism's development, an economic primer about the madness of financialization, an intervention into kind of ongoing debates about the so-called New Cold War and the Second Cold War, or the Second Cold War, sorry, and even partly a memoir and a piece of speculative fiction, just very briefly. But ultimately, kind of what the book aims to do is to convince us of this emergence of what you call techno-feudalism in the place of kind of, you know, trust-sealed capitalist dynamics. So my first question is really broad. Could you just outline your thesis? What is techno-feudalism and why is capitalism's death not necessarily something to celebrate?
The deeper cause that led me to writing this book is because, like many people, I've sensed that this crisis that we're experiencing, whether you live in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Europe, in Asia, wherever you might be, is not like the previous crisis. There is something different about us, something deeper, something alien, something that is not redemptive, because sometimes, usually, crises are redemptive. So if you have over, you know, exuberance, too much debt, or expectations that are too great, you need a little bit of a correction in order to recover from that. That's what a redemptive crisis used to be. But this crisis that we're experiencing, especially after 2008, is not redemptive. And then at some point, I started feeling myself, sensing that what's happening is similar to what was going on towards the end of the 18th century, when the world was being transformed. After centuries of feudalism, a new system, a new way of doing things was emerging, which was in the end capitalism. And that great transformation meant that power shifted from land to machinery to capital, from rent to profit. And something similar was happening to it. And that was the real cause of our these feelings, this sensation that the world is changing in profound ways, not simply, you know, in a sine wave going up and down. So here's my thesis. Sounds exaggerated, sounds crazy, some people would say. Because you see, wherever we look, what we see is the triumph of capital. Capital triumphs everywhere. From the land to the real estate world to education, health, of course, commerce, in space. You know, now we have private companies reaching the moon and owning the moon very soon. We have capital triumphing in the genotype, in women's wombs, with surrogacy, and so on. So how dare I say that capitalism is dead when capital is so triumphant? Well, that's precisely my point. My point is that capital became so triumphant and so unhinged that, like a stupid virus, it mutated into such a potent virus that it killed off its host, capitalism. And to be slightly more precise, so that doesn't sound like an airy-fairy kind of theory, capitalism for me is a system that is predicated on two things. Two are the main elements of capitalism, or pylons on which it sits. One is markets. Everything happens through markets under capitalism. So, you know, under feudalism, people worked. There was no labor market, no land market, real estate market. People worked. The sheriff, on behalf of the landlord, would collect a substantial percentage of the harvest. There was no market there. Then there would be a market. You know, some of that harvest surplus would be sold off, and there were markets for spices and this and that. But most of what people did not go through markets. Capitalism puts the market at the center. That's one of the two elements of capitalism. The second element is, of course, profit. It's not rent. It's not the share of the produce that the feudal lord collected. It was the entrepreneurial profit, the profit collected by those capitalists who organized production around markets. And it seems to me that today, if you look carefully at where the power lies, it lies with those who own a particular kind of capital, which lives in our phones, which lives in on this laptop, in this laptop, or to be more precise, in the cloud, which of course is not the cloud. It is, you know, the huge server farms and the optic fiber cables and the cell towers and so on. This is machinery. It's a kind of capital, but it's a kind of capital which is very different to steam engines and industrial robots and all that. The people who own that power have managed to replace markets with digital platforms like anything from Amazon and Alibaba to Uber and Airbnb. And those are not markets. They look like markets, but they're not markets. If you look carefully at what Amazon does, it's not a market. It's a trading platform, but it is not a marketplace. It belongs to one person who collects 40% of everything you pay on it, right? And that's much more like feudalism. Of course, it's a kind of techno-feudalism because it's not on land that he has inherited. It is on a cloud fiefdom that he has created out of research, development, and investment. That's why I'm not saying that we're going back to feudalism. We're going forward to something that looks like feudalism, but isn't. It's techno-feudalism. And the second thing, of course, is that profits are disappearing. Now you have almost no correlation between profits and valuation of companies in the New York Stock Exchange. So, yeah, Facebook and Airbnb and Uber hardly ever made a profit. Some of them never made a profit. So profit is being sidelined in favor of a kind of rent. It's not ground rent. It's rent for access to those cloud fiefdoms, digital platforms, which is, again, kind of ground rent, but also only for access to the cloud version of land. And so as I was thinking of all this, I was trying to imagine what the repercussions would be for younger people, people of your generation and younger generations. What the repercussions of that could be in the macroeconomic crisis, bouts of unemployment, the quality of jobs that are available to young people and not so young people, the effect on geopolitics, the new Cold War. In my estimation, the more I thought of it, the more I converged to the view that the new Cold War that Donald Trump started between the United States and China has at its basis, at its epicenter, this contest between the cloud capital of Silicon Valley and Wall Street on one hand and the Chinese cloud capital, the only other cloud capital in the world. Europe doesn't have any. That explains, if you want, the growing insignificance of the European Union and of Europe. So there, you know, one thought led to another and this book came out.
Right. And I think sort of an important distinction that you make within that kind of whole description of techno-feudalism is, you know, someone might say capitalism has always used kind of technological innovation to kind of maximize what we might call like a relative surplus value, I suppose, in Marxist terms. So the internet is always going to be vulnerable to co-optation by the ruling class or, I don't know, what you might call a kind of digital enclosure. So how is what we're witnessing today kind of different to simple incorporation into capitalist dynamics? So the distinction between cloud proles and cloud serfs is quite important there, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's central. It's central because, under monopoly capitalism, which was a phase of capitalism, you know, the Gilded Age, Henry Fords and the Westinghouses and the Edisons, they had a lot of power, which was based on technology. But they were very different beasts to Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg because they were in the business of cornering a market. A market which existed, they were cornering. And they were using their capital in order to concentrate it, to have more power, to buy politics, to ensure that, for instance, you know, the city of Chicago or New York or Los Angeles and San Francisco got rid of their trams and replaced them with their cars, or that their electricity was being monopolized. But in the end, they were selling industrial products. They were selling things that their capital goods, their produced means of production, were producing, manufacturing, in association with proletarians. Jeff Bezos doesn't care about production. He doesn't produce anything. He simply produces the fiefdom, the digital fiefdom, where he has encased both users whose actual work in grading, in liking or not liking, in posting reviews of books, of products and so on, add to his capital without them getting a single penny from him. That has never happened before, you know. Before big tech, it was only workers that created and engineers who created capital goods, like tractors and industrial robots. Now you and I are replenishing and reproducing the cloud capital of somebody like Bezos, who uses it in order to attract to his fiefdom, to his platform, capitalists who produce their and sell on it their books, their gadgets, their bicycles, their binoculars, whatever it is that they're selling. He collects 40% rent from them, cloud rent. And all this capital accumulation is creating, is turning the majority who are not proletarians into cloud serfs, and the capitalists are being turned into vassals. And that's not capitalism as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I suppose there are two kinds of interlocking strands to your warnings about techno-feudalism, insofar as firstly, you've got a structural argument about the way in which cloud capital's kind of material basis sucks profits into the hands of what you call cloudlists via rent extraction. And then there's another kind of strand about how techno-feudalism affects, like, I suppose, the psychological or affective realms, like creating these new compulsions and imperatives. So, you know, someone approaching this concept might think, well, you know, people have been trying to sell me stuff for you know, decades and decades. Like, how is this different? You know, in some ways, the critique surrounding manufacturing of desires are fairly well-worn arguments. So could you just expand a bit about, you know, on how cloud platforms are manipulating us in new ways and generating kind of new forms of, you know, morbid forms of sociality, really?
Humanity has been under the spell of very talented people who had the capacity to modify our behavior and our thinking since we developed language. So there's nothing new about that, as you put it. Indeed, advertising made a corporate success out of grabbing our attention through television, through posters in highways, and inputting desires into our bosom, into our mind, into our heart. I use in the book, I use Don Draper as a paradigm. Mm. That the character, the protagonist, fictional protagonist in Mad Men, one of my favorite series on television. The point I'm making about techno-feudalism is that for the first time in the history of humanity, this behavioral modification, the propaganda, if you want, has been automated. Don Draper is no longer a human being. It is an algorithm. And it is an algorithm that manages to do the most dialectical of things. Don Draper, the fictional character of the archetypal advertiser or marketer, is this mythical, talented person who sits on a couch, consumes a lot of bourbon, and occasionally comes up with a brilliant idea on how to convince us to buy a Coca-Cola or, you know, Big Macs or, you know, Ford cars or to buy a particular kind of camera or whatever, right? But that's one way and indirect. So it's one way in the sense that he has this idea, he designs a brilliant poster or television ad, which goes from the transmitter, whether that is the poster or the television station, into me, into my senses. And that's it, one way, end of story. If he convinces me to buy it, I buy it. But then the reason why I'm saying it's indirect is because if I get convinced that I want to buy a Big Mac, I have to go to McDonald's to buy it. Now, with the algorithmic or cloud capital, as I put it, as I describe it, you've got the algorithm that works, let's say, on Amazon's Alexa or the Google Assistant or just anything that lives in TikTok or Facebook, and so on. And what happens is that this algorithm is automated. It's not a human being. I train it to train me, to train it, to train me, to train it, to train me. That's why I'm saying this is an infinite dialectical regress. This is a two-way process now. It's an infinite two-way process, whereby I'm being trained to train it, to be trained to train it, to give it a fantastically good mapping of who I am and what I care about, so that the machine gives me, the algorithm gives me great advice on what books to buy and what music to listen to. So yeah, I don't know about you, but Spotify knows me. It knows me brilliantly. When Spotify suggests a particular kind of music, I may not absolutely adore it, but I will never dislike it because it knows me. So, and we're impressionable human beings. And this individuated two-way dialectical process is a remarkable process for convincing me to buy stuff. And with AI now being added as an additional layer to it, you know, when the interface becomes far more personal through AI with GPT-5, which hasn't come out, but it will come out, that power is risen to the nth. The machine learns me so well, it knows how to put into my mind that I want to buy something. But moreover, it then proceeds with a direct sale. It sells it to me directly. So the same algorithm that Amazon uses in order to learn me so that it can tell me to buy X, sells me X directly, bypassing markets. And it is the same algorithm. That is what really fascinates me and throws me. The same algorithm is driving the proletarian in the Amazon warehouse, who's, you know, wearing something like this on his or her wrist, and monitors the rate and the pace at which or with which this worker goes around about the Amazon warehouse, finding the item that it has convinced me to buy and sending it to me directly. You know, it's Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times meets Terry Gilliam's Brazil, if anybody has watched this movie.
That's a great movie. Watch it. So just kind of looking more broadly at kind of where you're intervening with this book, because it's certainly not the first to recognize the all-encompassing power of big tech and Silicon Valley. I guess the most well-known instantiation is Shoshana Zuboff's surveillance capitalism, which conceptualizes big tech power more in terms of monopolization. Cory Doctorow is another one that springs to mind. Mackenzie Walk has grappled with the death of capitalism as kind of useful concept to which to index various forms of oppression. So I'm just wondering what you felt was kind of missing from these debates, any potential missteps in these theories. Yeah, just where your book kind of makes this intervention, really.
Well, I love all three books you mentioned.
Okay.
But I think that I'm telling a story which is importantly different. To begin with, regarding surveillance capitalism, well, clearly I disagree that this is still capitalism. You see, Zuboff maps out beautifully the way we're surveyed and the way in which the algorithms troll our minds and maximize the power of the advertisers upon us. She's very good at that. Where I think we need to make one step beyond is to conceptualize this algorithmic capital not as a brainwashing machine, but as a new form of capital. A form of capital which is not a produced means of production, but it is a produced means of behavioral modification, which creates its own category of surplus value rent extraction, and it creates a new dynamic. So it is crucial for me, and I try to argue that in the book, that we realize that this cloud capital, this is a new form of capital. It is not as if the monopolists, the same old monopolists of yesteryear, have now a greater power to brainwash us. This is not just a question of us being brainwashed. The form of capital that they have developed, which I call cloud capital, has created a new socioeconomic mode of production, which is no longer capitalist. And that has repercussions that go very well beyond brainwashing. And let me be a bit more specific. And that's where Cory Doctorow is very strong, very good at identifying that. If you read Surveillance Capitalism by Zuboff, it is focused on how the conglomerate that sells stuff to us becomes far more powerful as a result of this algorithmic capital. Well, that misses a very important point. Capitalists producing stuff are also hugely exploited by the Jeff Bezos, by the Cloudalists. So it is not as if this algorithm, these algorithms, are simply boosting the capacity of capitalists to exploit us and to make us buy stuff, to brainwash us. No. The split happens within capital. There are those who own cloud capital and those who do not and own just capital. The one who make the electric bikes, huh? They're capitalists. But they are just as exploited as you and me are by the cloudalists. So that is the new dimension that my book brings in. The idea that the split of capital in capital and cloud capital creates a process by which the standard capitalists are becoming vassals. And the surplus value that capitalists extract from workers in the factory is now siphoned off away from the capitalist class towards this new class, this new ruling class of the owners of cloud capital. That's the fundamental difference. Now, with Mackenzie Work, I love her book. I think it's a great book. I read it as I was in the middle of writing my own, I have to say. And I was very happy to read it because suddenly I realized I'm not the only madman or mad person who thinks that this is something substantial, that this is much more than surveillance capitalism, because Mackenzie Work agrees on that. There's nothing that is in that book that I disagree with. And I think it is a very forward-looking and pressing book. My difference is that she's talking about the death of capital. I'm talking about the birth of a new form of capital, cloud capital. Now, Cory Doctorow is a hero to me. I absolutely adore his blog. I adore his books. The internet con is a must read. And I'm very glad that he has good things to say about techno-feudalism, my book.
Okay.
He has developed, he puts a much more emphasis on what he calls, he's got this great term, which I'm sure you know, enchitification.
Yeah.
which is very consistent with my view of cloud capital. You know, these cloud fiefdoms, which attract both users and exploit us as cloud serfs and capitalists are turned into vassals, and how the moment they grab us, yeah, that's what Corey explains beautifully, then they just pile lots of shit on both consumers, users, and producers, because again, the slight difference of opinion, different emphasis that I have from Corey, is that he's looking at ways in which this entitification process can be regulated, can be impeded.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that interested in that. Because even if, you know, regulatory authorities stop Google, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok from entitifying their cloud fiefs, that will simply mean that cloud capital is not going to undermine itself. But mm-hmm. it will undermine society, and it will undermine any prospect of democracy, any prospect of an environmental movement that arrests the steady march towards climate catastrophe. I emphasize not regulation, as Corey does, but the importance of taking over the algorithms and socializing them.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we need intensification as like a means for, I don't know, raise people's consciousness about, you know, the shittiness of living under techno-feudalism, maybe. So could you kind of just briefly touch, because I'm not an economist, I found it really helpful, a lot of the parts of the book, which were, you know, very accessible in that sense. Could you briefly touch on how the emergence of techno-feudalism was aided by the financial kind of chicanery that took place around the 2008 crisis, because I think it's quite useful to know the history here in terms of how the cloudalists you described took advantage of what was, you know, a relatively short-lived moment in the trajectory of finance capitalism, really.
Louisa, I think that you should count your blessings. You're not an economist, because if you had spent 10, 15 years infecting your mind with economic models, then your capacity to understand what's happening around the world would have been diminished. I am an economist who actually thinks that economics is bad for our mental health and our capacity to understand the world we live in. But having said that, Let me answer your question. Okay, so there are two main processes that were working in parallel to one another, and coincidentally in parallel to one another, to bring about the rise of cloud capital and the emergence of technical feudalism. One was the steady privatization of the internet. The original internet was a kind of commons until a new enclosure was begun by big tech to privatize it and to use the fact that you and I do not own our digital identity. You cannot prove who you are on the internet unless a bank or Google vouch for you. Not owning our digital identity is massive. It's such a fantastic opportunity for those cloud elites to take control and privatize the whole thing. So think about, why do you need Uber to call a taxi or Lyft? Because you do not own your digital identity. You can't say it on the internet, my name is Riza, I'm at the intersection of such and such street, and I want to go to the airport. You can't do that because, nobody knows who you are, really. You can't prove who you are. But Uber does, because you have given them your credit card account. So a bank has told the conglomerate who you are, and therefore you are encased in Uber once you use Uber, as are the proletarians working behind the wheel. Okay, but that process was due to the privatization of the internet through the fact that we do not own our identity. That's one process. It's happening. Mm-hmm. It was happening before 2008. The second process, of course, was the repercussions of the 2008 complete collapse of Wall Street and the panic in which people like Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time under George W. Bush, and then after that, Tim Geithner, appointed by Barack Obama. From early 2009 onwards, the central banks of the United States, of the United Kingdom, of the European Union, of Japan, of Sweden, of Switzerland, and so on and so forth, they started printing, in my estimation, they printed $35 trillion between 2009 and last year. And they gave it to the bankers. They gave it to the financiers. Now, if you're a banker, your number one nightmare scenario is to have billions and not being able to lend it to someone. That's your nightmare, is to have money, not any customers to borrow it from you. The problem was that at the same time that they were printing these trillions, the central banks, the governments were imposing austerity. In the United Kingdom, of course, in Greece, here we were the champions of austerity. In Germany, in France, in the United States as well. Obama talked about the stimulus, it was never real. If you put together the state governments and the federal government together, they were practicing austerity. So when you have huge quantities of money in the banks and very little money around outside the banks, capitalists are not going to invest because they look at the little people and say, as if I'm going to invest, those people won't have the money to buy high value-added stuff from me. But you have the bank calling you. You don't want to invest because the little people have no money, but the bank calls you and says, I've got $200 million. Do you want it? I'll give it to you for free. No interest. You say, okay. If you really want me to take it, I'll take it. I'll take it off your hands. And then what do you do with it? You don't want to invest it, right? You don't want to spend it because you have to give it back, even though the interest rate is zero. So what you do is you go to Wall Street and you buy back your own shares with the money that the central bank gave you. And that pushes your share price up. If you're the CEO, your bonus is linked to the share price. You're laughing all the way to the bank, okay? So capital did not get reproduced. I mean, it was not replenished. It was no investment took place between 2009 and 2020. Very little investment, real investment, machines and so on. The only capitalists who actually invested in capital were the Jeff Bezos and the Zuckerbergs, the big tech people, who took it. So they took trillions provided by the state to create the cloud capital that gave them a capacity to extract from cloud serves free labor, and from capitalists, all those profits. That's more or less the story.
Yeah, that was really helpful. But let's just pivot to another kind of significant element of your argument, I don't want to miss this bit out, which relates to kind of the global impact of techno-feudalist dynamics and the emergence of the so-called new Cold War with China. So could you just give us a brief overview of this chapter? How has cloud capital disrupted dollar hegemony, and how are the US and China kind of making moves to protect their cloud fiefdoms?
Well, to introduce our audience to the way in which my thinking evolved about this, why is there a new Cold War? Why did Donald Trump start the new Cold War against China when, you remember, in 2016, he banned Huawei from the United States? Mm-hmm. And then he banned another one, ZTE. And then it all started. Now, there are people, of course, who always say, oh, Donald Trump is a madman, but do you expect him to have reasons? Well, I never believe that. He's an evil person, but he's not a madman. And in any case, when Joe Biden, who is the anti-Trump, came in, he didn't stop that. He turbocharged it. Mm-hmm. You know, he actually made the Cold War between the United States and China even harsher and far more dangerous with the ban of selling of any technologically advanced microchips to China. It's effectively like declaring an economic war against China. So I was asking questions, and I wasn't getting any answers. The answers I were getting were really inane, like Taiwan, as if Taiwan is a new thing. It's been happening since 1950. Or that, you know, anyway. So I started thinking very hard and carefully about it. And my conclusion is this. The reason why the United States is so hegemonic, especially after 1971, the end of Bretton Woods, when it went into the red, the United States is the only superpower in the history of the world, compared to the Roman Empire, the Spanish Empire, the Dutch, the British Empire, even the Soviet Union, the only empire in the history of the world whose power rose as it was getting more into the red. That is remarkable, right? And of course, the reason is the dollar. Because the dollar plays a role that no currency has ever played in the past, not even dominant currencies like the British pound or pound sterling. What has been happening since the 1970s is the United States is expanding its trade deficit. So it imports a lot more into the United States than it exports. Now, no other country can do this, because if you keep doing this, then you go bankrupt, your currency is going to collapse. But because the dollar was the only currency in the world that people wanted, that capitalists wanted, even if they didn't want to buy anything from the United States. So take, for instance, Britain. If you want pound sterling and you're not in Britain, why do you want pound sterling? Because you want to buy something from the Brits, whether this is, you know, British aerospace engine, or you want to go on holiday to Britain and therefore you need to have pounds to spend in Britain. Right? The American currency is the only currency people want, even if they don't want to buy anything from the United States. Why? Because if you want to buy oil, you need dollars to buy it. So even if you buy oil from Nigeria that has been refined by a French company and you buy this in Algeria, again, you need dollars for it. Copper, rare earths. If you've got lots of money, if you are, you know, a Saudi Arabian magnate, oil magnate, what are you going to store your money in? So, yeah, essentially, you take your money and you take it to Wall Street, and therefore you are financing the deficit of the United States, both the trade deficit and the budget deficit, the government deficit. And this is remarkable. It's an amazing scheme the United States has created, whereby effectively it gains strength from other people's profits. Because if you are a German car company, Mercedes, right? You sell Mercedes to the Americans in Miami, in California, you get dollars. This is like IOUs. The Americans print them and give them to you. And what do you do with those? You take them back to Wall Street. So the loop is recycled. But that is predicated upon the dollar system being the world payment system. Ask ourselves the following question. If my thesis is right, that cloud capital is now becoming the major source of power generally, economic power, political power, discursive power, who's got cloud capital? The Americans and the Chinese, nobody else. So there is a Google, And there is a Chinese Google, there's no European Google, there's no Latin American Google, there's no Indian Google, there's no Russian Google, right? But there is a Chinese Google called Baidu. There is Jeff Bezos' Amazon.com, and there is Jack Ma's Alibaba. There is no German one, there is no French one. So there's cloud capital in the United States, and there's cloud capital in China. The difference is that the Chinese cloud capital is bigger and better than the American one, which concentrates the mind just to say it. And why is that? It's not that the Chinese are cleverer than the Americans, technologically wise, no. In the United States, you have a schism between the East Coast and the West Coast, between Wall Street, which is in New York, and Silicon Valley, which is in California. Wall Street bankers hate big tech. They loathe it. Why? Because big tech, Apple and Google and all these people, have what it takes to replace Wall Street. If with internet banking, internet technologies, with what's called fintech, financial technologies, Apple could replace the Bank of America like that tomorrow morning. That doesn't happen because the federal government and the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, is in the pockets of Wall Street, and they would not allow Apple to replace Bank of America. So there is a conflict within the United States between financial capital and cloud capital. In China, that conflict doesn't exist because the Chinese Communist Party makes sure that the financial capitalists and the cloud capitalists in China work as one. So in China, there is an app you can have on your phone called WeChat. WeChat is an app that we don't have in the West because we're not allowed to have it in the West. We could have it, but we don't have it. Because WeChat allows you to do what Netflix does. You can watch a movie, Spotify, listen to music, send messages, emails, do your shopping, what Amazon.com, all that you can do on WeChat. And you could do something else that you cannot do here in the West. And that is make payments for free to any bank account. Anybody who has one account in the world, you can make payments to and receive payments for no fee. That would be a nightmare for Wall Street. Right? Now, and so this is how we come to the new Cold War. As we speak, and this was the result of some research I did while I was writing the book, 2 years ago, there were German producers, manufacturers, who had WeChat accounts and another application, payments application, that was made available by the Central Bank of China, the state-owned Central Bank of China, a digital wallet. And that is a remarkable thing for a German manufacturer to have. And I use the example in the book. And this is a real example. I use pseudonyms, not actual names. Take France, who has a manufacturing facility somewhere in Hamburg, making propellers, ship propellers, large, huge propellers, using aluminium that he imports from China. And then the propeller, once he makes it in Hamburg, he sends it to China, to a shipyard, to be installed on a ship, right? Now, this firm is doing business with China, both in terms of importing and exporting. Normally, he would have to have an account in Deutsche Bank or Finance Bank, and to make payments through the European Central Bank, the American dollar payment system, going to the Central Bank of China, and then going to the private bank account, Chinese bank account of his partner in China, in Shenzhen, in Shanghai. And then the money would have to go backwards when he sells a propeller. With this app that I'm referring to, right? Of course, it is in one, but he doesn't care because he buys in one, he sells in one. At the press of a button, no fees, not going through the European Central Bank, not going through the Fed, not going through the Western payment system, not going through the dollar system. These transactions can take place. That transaction which I just described is a clear and present nightmare for Washington, D.C., because it means that its monopoly over the payment system that keeps American hegemony going in proportion to America's deficits is gone. That is more dangerous for the United States than a nuclear warhead. Mm-hmm. And that is, for me, why there is a major clash now between the United States and China.
Yeah, great. Thank you. That's really comprehensive. And I guess a good kind of question, final question really, is what do we do about techno-feudalism? So in the book you talk about, I suppose, the relative insufficiency or ill-suitedness of kind of labor union organizing and standing up to the power of cloud capital. But I suppose some of the left's prescriptions for tackling capitalism still apply. Maybe organizing, boycotting, raising consciousness, to use a kind of old-fashioned term. Where do we go from here, I suppose?
They're completely and totally topical and to the point. We need to. There is no substitute for organizing political action. The solution is not technical. There's no technical fix to techno-feudalism. There's only political intervention, solidarity, and it has to be internationalist, because cloud capital, like financial capital, is internationalist. We need to be internationalist. So to cut a very long answer short, there is the question of means and ends. What weapons, instruments do we use, ways, methods, and what is our objective? In terms of the methods, I think that it is essential. It's not enough to organize workers anymore. Mm-hmm. You need to organize the cloud service as well. You know, the people who are on the phones. So here's an example of something I've tried, we're trying, some of us are trying. Imagine we want to support workers in an Amazon warehouse like Chris Smalls in New Jersey, who struggled to create a small union there to negotiate better terms and conditions for Amazon workers. Well, imagine if we had a global campaign one day, let's say next Monday or on Black Friday or whenever, of saying international solidarity with the workers in Staten Island, New Jersey, Amazon workers. Nobody visits Amazon.com for one day. Nobody. Just, it's not a great sacrifice. You just don't visit Amazon.com for one day. Not forever. Just for one day. And start a rolling strike, which we do every Black Friday. When I say we, I'm referring to the Progressive International that I'm part of. With some success, you start a strike inside Amazon warehouses from Vietnam all the way to Seattle on a day when cloud serves go on strike. They don't visit Amazon.com. This kind of combination of organizing workers and organizing cloud serves is, I think, the way to that is the means. The end should be the socialization of cloud capital, because regulation and taxation is not going to work. Because anybody who owns that cloud capital, those algorithms, the AI, is going to have an inordinate amount of power over the rest of society, which they are going to use in a way that is detrimental to our capacity to reproduce ourselves as a species. In the end, they will commit suicide too. They don't know it, but they will, because, you know, our planet is going to eject us as a species if we continue this way. So that's the short answer to a very, very, very poignant question.
Great, thank you. So finally, I suppose now that techno-feudalism is kind of out in the world, you might have other things going on. I've heard talk of a new documentary you've been involved with. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about that. What's going on now?
Well, thank you for asking, because it's not so much about me. It's there's a young British artist. His name is Raul Martinez. Raul Martinez. He's a great portrait artist. His paintings are in the National Portrait Gallery in London. He's a magnificent young man. He's a philosopher, he's an author, he's a filmmaker, a painter. And he honored me some years ago by locking me up for more than a week in a studio, 5 hours a day, picking our brains in front of the camera. He created his own thing. I may be a talking head there, but he's created a documentary, a six-part documentary called In the Eye of the Storm. And if you want to visit it, if anybody wants to visit it, just go to Eye of the Storm, not in the eye, eyeofthestorm.info, I-N-F-O, and you can watch it there. And, you know, that's his story, and it's a remarkable story about capitalism, about techno-feudalism, about the climate disaster that we are facing and your generation is facing. But since you asked me about what I'm doing, look, I'm involved in politics, right? But this is boring. I'm not going to bother you with that. I'm running the elections here, European Parliament elections. So I'm just bored even saying it. But I'm writing another book now, because I always need to have a book for therapy. I don't have a psychotherapist. I don't take drugs. Maybe I should. But I write books as therapy. And this is about women that have influenced me from my family circle, especially women that I never got to know, who influenced me through other women that I did get to know. Like, for instance, a grandmother of mine that I discovered after my father died 2 years ago, that she was a member of the Egyptian Feminist Union in 1923 in Cairo, organizing women's strikes and the solidarity health networks. Fascinating.
Yeah, that sounds, yeah, it sounds really interesting. I'm impressed you found books as writing books as a way to as a therapy. It's not necessarily something that everyone who writes book would agree with, I think. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Yanis.
Well, thank you.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much for supporting books, not just me, but just books in general.
Yeah, thank you.